Okay. Today I'm going to be talking about the Franco-Russian alliance, a very important step in the road to the First World War. And in fact, the whole question of the origins of the First World War is going to be our focus for the rest of the course. How is it to be understood? And we're going to approach that issue through we're looking at the story through the lens of international relations theory. Not because we're simply taking the claims of international relations theorists on faith, but because their particular way of looking at things will allow us to bring some key issues into focus. Right? Will allow us to kind of draw meaning from this story that might otherwise just be a jumble of historical facts. Right? And the theorist I want to kind of use for that purpose today is John Mearsheimer. John Mearsheimer, professor at the University of Chicago. Next to Waltz, he's probably the most important contemporary international relations theorist. He wrote this book laying out his basic thinking, his basic understanding of how international relations works, the tragedy of great power politics. You know, as always, the title is worth thinking about. It's the same basic view as the Waltz view. Right? It's not enough that countries would desire peace for you to have a stable international system, a peaceful international order. Why isn't it enough? Because everyone has to be concerned above all with their security. And to provide for your own security, you have to make sure that you're as strong as possible. You have to reach for power. Okay? But if everyone is reaching for a bigger and bigger slice of the pie, for more and more power in the system, that's to say, you know, in comparison with everyone else, you're bound to have conflict. Right? The basic structure of the system, a system of sovereign states, a system where there's no overarching authority to provide for everyone's security, pushes states into conflict with each other. You know, and that's why it's tragic. You know, maybe nobody wants war, but the system forces people into a conflict with each other, whether they want it or not. Right? And Mearsheimer goes on, he has this whole notion of what's possible in terms of this reaching for power. And he says basically, countries want to dominate their own local region. They want to become, in the term that's used in this literature, a hegemon. They want to reach for hegemony, for dominance. But they can't hope to dominate the entire world. And so the most that they can realistically aspire to is regional hegemony, you know, local hegemony, dominance just over the region in which they find themselves. Right? And then he goes on and he says, but once a country achieves regional hegemony, and there's only been one power that's achieved regional hegemony, the country in which we happen to live, that's not the end of the story, because once you achieve regional hegemony, you do have to worry about what goes on in other regions, and you want to prevent rival hegemons from emerging in other regions, because once they do, they can mess around in your region. Right? This is the Mearsheimer argument, but the argument is, basically, you know, countries are always striving to achieve regional hegemony. That's their number one goal that they put for themselves. Right? They don't do it in this kind of mindless way. They're not going to precipitate a war to achieve hegemony if they're going to lose that war. The balance of power has to be favorable for them to do this. Right? So he looks at a number of these attempts that countries have made in modern history to reach for regional hegemony. And there's a kind of canonical list. In the 20th century, you basically have these four cases. Imperial Germany, Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan in East Asia, and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Okay? And his whole interpretation of these four episodes is in line with that general theory. You want to understand the First World War? This is an attempt on the part of Germany to achieve regional hegemony, to dominate Europe, to become the number one power in Europe. And that's what gives meaning to the story. Germans can't do very much during the Bismarckian period from 1871 to 1890. Why not? Because Germany wasn't strong enough. Germany is industrializing very rapidly in this period. Germany is going to become the number one industrial power in Europe, replacing England. Hasn't achieved it yet. It's only after the fall of Bismarck, especially after the turn of the 20th century, that Germany can look forward to becoming the number one industrial power in Europe, and therefore the number one military power. And when Germany sees that goal, can't help itself. It's going to make a run at regional hegemony. The whole argument is like almost a mechanical argument. Right? You don't need conscious aggression. It's just built into the structure of the system. You know, when you have these imbalances of power, countries can't help themselves. Right? They behave in accordance with these basic laws that people like Mearsheimer think they've identified. So he applies this theory to the interpretation of German policy in this period. Moderate under Bismarck, not because this was a policy choice, but because Germany was too weak to take on the rest of Europe. But after 1890, there's a shift. It wasn't just because Bismarck fell. Bismarck couldn't have pursued the policy he had been pursuing after 1890 if he had remained in power, according to Mearsheimer. And then he looks at what the other powers are doing and how they're reacting to this shift of power toward Germany, the concentration of power in the hands of Germany. And the basic notion is the other local great powers will come together. They'll balance this would-be hegemon, right? They'll form a countervailing coalition that would limit how far Germany can go. Why? Because that's the only way to provide for their own security, to protect their own independence. And if they don't do it, and Germany becomes too powerful, then they'll have to live under the shadow of German power. They'll be satellites or whatever. Right? So they have to come together. That's the meaning of the anti-German coalition. It's called the Triple Entente, right? This is the bloc that consisted of these three powers that came together against Germany before World War I, the decade before World War I, basically. France, Russia, and Britain. And these three powers came together, not all at once, but in a series of moves. First, there was the Franco-Russian alliance that I'm going to be talking about today in the early 1890s. And then there was the Anglo-French Entente of 1904. And then this was completed by the Anglo-Russian Entente of 1907, the Triple Entente. Right? And the hope was that these three other powers would come together because they all felt threatened by this rising German power, a German power that was tempted to reach for hegemony in Europe, that they would be able to hold the line against Germany. Right? And only when it was clear that they couldn't do the trick by themselves that the United States intervened. The United States came into the First World War only because the local great powers couldn't, you know, do the job on their own. America had to intervene to prevent Germany from becoming a rival hegemon, from dominating Europe. That's the Mearsheimer theory, right? And he applies it in particular to the case of the Franco-Russian alliance that I'm going to be talking about today. What does he say about this? He says, his point here is France and Russia came together because they were threatened by Germany. And why were they threatened by Germany? Not because of anything Germany did. Germany wasn't aggressive in this period. They came together simply because they were afraid of German power. They were afraid of the way the balance of industrial power was changing. Germany was industrializing more rapidly than anybody else. And then an industrial power translates into military power. It's the main determinant of how a war will be fought and what the outcome of a war will be. Okay? Not Germany's aggressive behavior. He says, that's the way a lot of people interpret the run-up to the war and the formation of the anti-German coalition. You know, it's like, well, people are reacting to aggressive German behavior. He says, no. He says, a close look at how the Entente was formed reveals that the main driving force behind its creation was Germany's growing economic and military might, not its aggressive behavior. Right? And he says specifically about what we're going to be talking about today. France and Russia came together because they were scared of Germany's growing power, not because Germany behaved aggressively or foolishly. And his proof? Well, Germany didn't behave aggressively or foolishly in the 1890s. Right? He says specifically that Bismarck's successes precipitated no significant crises between 1890 and 1900. But they came together anyway. And for Mearsheimer, what this shows is that it's the structure of international politics, the structure of power, that's the principal determinant of the behavior of states. Right? If true, you know, that would be a very important insight. Because you like to believe that countries choose their policies, that they make political decisions. They decide on a particular course of action. And those policy choices have fundamental consequences. Right? You like to think that if a country is modest and careful and well-behaved and very cautious in terms of its foreign policy goals, it's not going to be isolated. It's not going to have other countries ganging up on it. Mearsheimer says, no, it doesn't have anything to do with that. Basically, it's Germany is becoming stronger because of the way the German economy is developing. That's why these countries are coming together. Right? If true, this would be very important. How do you go about seeing whether it's true or not? There's only one answer. You know, the Mearsheimer approach is a very broad brush approach. You know, the tragedy of great power politics in general. To get a handle on these issues, you have to unpack it. You have to look at it now under a magnifying glass. It's like shifting the levels of magnification on a microscope. Right? So that's what we want to do. We want to see whether it's in fact the case that France and Russia came together because they both felt threatened by Germany. Right? That this was a balancing coalition aimed at providing a counterweight to German power because the rise of German power threatened their security. Okay? All right, so it's with that theory in mind that we turn to the history, to the actual story. What is the actual story? Fundamental change in 1890. 1890 is the year that Bismarck is forced out by the new young Kaiser, William II, the German Emperor. Who now intends to pretty much, play a key role, personal role in the making of German policy. Bismarck is forced out, and within the space of a few years, there's this diplomatic revolution in Europe. Instead of the Bismarck system, this kind of balanced system, where Germany maintained a certain relationship with Russia, embodied in and symbolized by the reinsurance treaty of 1887, right? Now, that wire to St. Petersburg, as Bismarck liked to put it, was cut. And Russia went over to the side of France, Germany's main adversary in European politics. Franco-Russian Entente of 1891, followed by the Franco-Russian Alliance of 1893-94. By the way, why do I put those 2 years? Because this alliance was not embodied in a treaty that was signed and ratified. As a matter of fact, under the Constitution, or basic law of the Third Republic, the Parliament didn't even have to ratify treaties. Didn't have to, alliances could be made by the executive without any input from Parliament. And this particular alliance was embodied not in a treaty, but in an exchange of notes. And one note was sent at the end of 1893, and it was responded to by another note at the beginning of 1894. That's why sometimes you see this as the alliance of 1893, other times you see the alliance of 1894. Little detail. These things could sometimes be a little confusing. But this is a fundamental change, the Franco-Russian counterweight. Clearly an important step on the road to 1914. Right? How's it to be understood? Well, we said this many times. The Bismarck system of the 1870s and 1880s was not rock solid by any means. Right? This was a system that was based on the idea that Germany needed to be part of the dominant coalition in Europe. In a Europe of five great powers, the key thing was to be one of three. Well, what block of three was possible? Not one that included France. Basically, there were only two possible alignments. The alignment of the three Eastern empires, Germany, Austria, and Russia, or the anti-Russian alignment, the alignment based on the containment of Russia, Germany, Austria, Britain. Right? Neither alignment was totally satisfactory. And in a sense, you don't want just to have one iron in the fire, because if you just lock yourself into one alliance group, then you're the slave of your alliance partners. You want to have more than one iron in the fire. So this are balanced between those two possible alignments. He kept the relationship with Russia alive. We saw that, the two Dreyfus-Bund agreements and then the reinsurance treaty of 1887. And he also tried to maintain a certain relationship with Britain, especially when Britain had conservative governments. They were open to this sort of thing. So you have the Mediterranean agreements also of 1887, which tied the British to Germany and Austria in an alignment that had a certain anti-Russian flavor. It's not totally straightforward by any means. You know, does that mean it's a bad thing, by the way? People say, oh, this is an element of duplicity here. Certainly there was. Is Bismarck pro-Russian, anti-Russian? What is? He's balancing off between these two alignments, so he has to tell different people different things. Not straightforward by any means, and yet it's in the optimal solution from Germany's point of view. And also, if Germany is basically a status quo power, anything that enhances Germany's power is in the interest of the system as a whole, if your goal is to stabilize international politics. So should you be too quick to condemn duplicity? Well, it's a thin line between duplicity and subtlety. Right? Anyway, a lot of people didn't like this. They thought that Bismarck was overly subtle, you know, something that was not that straightforward. It just couldn't last indefinitely. In fact, it was there were many signs that this sort of arrangement was breaking down even before Bismarck fell from power. During 1887, you have a deterioration of relations between Germany and Russia, symbolized by the decision on the part of the German government not to allow the Russian government to float bonds in the Berlin market. The Russians then turned to France, and the French were very happy to step into the breach. And in fact, a certain financial relationship between France and Russia was one of the elements, one of the mainstays of the Franco-Russian relationship during this entire period. France generated a lot of excess capital, savings during this period. Partly this is because the French economy wasn't growing by leaps and bounds the way the German economy was. And this capital that resulted from French savings wasn't being invested at home. Whereas Russia had a great hunger for this. Russia, you know, understood herself to be the most backward of the European great powers and therefore needed to industrialize, needed to modernize. And to do that, Russia needed capital from more advanced countries. So you have a certain complementarity there between France and Russia. There's another straw in the wind was the fact that the Russians placed a big order in 1887 to buy French rifles, the Lebel rifle, to equip the Russian army with. You know, again, choosing France as a military supplier was this other you know, straw in the wind about which way Russia was going. Yeah, you know, the reason that the Russo-German relationship wasn't rock solid was, you know, in a sense, what is Russia getting out of this? Russia is not a status quo country. Russia is not interested in pursuing a purely defensive policy. See, this in a sense is another thing you have to take into account when you're making your assessment of the Mearsheimer theory. The Mearsheimer theory is, oh yeah, there's this, the number one power is reaching for hegemony and everyone else is just trying to hold the line and balance off that would-be hegemon. So, well, it's not that simple. Russia is not a status quo country. Russia, especially under Alexander III, we saw this when we talked about the Eastern Crisis in the late 1880s. Russia is interested in pursuing an expansionist policy, dominating the Eastern Balkans, not because she views herself as the liberator of the Slavic nationalities there, but because she wants to advance her own power, wants to dominate the Turkish Straits, the keys to her house, the Tsar Alexander III. Right. This is again, you look at the big sweep of Russian policy over the 17th and 18th century. This is a highly expansionist country. You don't get to be the largest country in the world by pursuing a purely defensive policy. Okay, so so you have this problem. What's in this relationship with Germany from the Russian point of view? If the Russians aren't getting the sorts of things that Bismarck had led them to think that they would get, such as dominance over the Eastern Balkans, because Bismarck was always talking about the partition of the Balkans into spheres of influence, a Russian sphere in the east and an Austrian sphere in the west. If that was just words, you know, maybe the Russians will say, we're not getting anything out of this. Why maintain this relationship? Why not go over to the side of France? Well, what kept the Russians in then? It was a sense that it was better to be in Germany's good graces, better to have a decent relationship with Germany than to be Germany's enemy. Maybe Russia wasn't getting as much from this relationship as she would have liked, but being enemies with Germany would be a whole lot worse. Not least because that would force Germany into dependence on Austria and into underwriting whatever policy the Austrians wanted to pursue in the Balkans. You see, these are second-order calculations. Okay. So the Russians want to stay in. See, this is an important point when you're assessing the Mearsheimer argument. They want to maintain this relationship with Germany because Germany is so strong, because Germany is the number one power in Europe. Right? Germany being the number one power in Europe, it's not an argument for balancing against Germany, it's an argument for maintaining good relations with Germany. Okay? And the relationship ends not because the Russians choose to end it, because they say, well, Germany is too strong, we've got to go over to the side of France to balance Germany. It's the Germans who push them away. And the story here is quite remarkable. As I say, 1890, Bismarck falls, and the reinsurance treaty is up for renewal. It had a three-year duration. And the initial inclination of the new German government and the Kaiser, William II, was to renew it. As a matter of fact, he had the Russian ambassador in Berlin awakened at 1 o'clock in the morning and summoned to the palace for breakfast the next morning just to tell him that policy hadn't changed and that Germany intended to renew the treaty. And it's, one of the elements in this whole story is William II is, he's slightly unbalanced. One, you know, it's like, you look at all these arguments about the democratic peace and so on. One of the big arguments in favor of democracy is you don't run the risk of having people like William II in charge of the policy of a great state. Okay, but the Germans then changed their mind. The argument now is that Germany can't pursue this Bismarckian policy anymore. Germany needs a, quote, clear and transparent policy. And the new German government, headed by a former general, General von Kaprivi, pursues a policy of placing Germany squarely behind an understanding with Britain. Right? Basically, this is the policy of the Mediterranean agreements. The Germans want to transform into something really solid so that you would have, an alignment that had some real substance to it. Germany, Austria, Britain, all together, not aggressive against Russia, but aimed at the containment of Russia. And that's kind of implicit in the Bismarck policy, and a lot of what Bismarck wanted to do was to kind of sugarcoat that so as to make it more palatable to Russia. But now the Germans said, we have to be open about this. We need a straightforward policy. And they pursue this policy of alignment with Britain. Kaiser goes over to Britain, and the crowds cheer him, and so on. It's a very important treaty, the Zanzibar-Helgoland treaty that's worked out between Germany and Britain. Basically, Germany had all these ambitions in East Africa, in the area around Zanzibar in East Africa. The new German government says, we're going to forget about all of our claims there in East Africa. A massive concession to the British. And in exchange for that, the British agreed to the retrocession of the island of Helgoland. Helgoland is a very small island off the German coast in the North Sea. It was had a certain strategic importance because of the approaches to Hamburg, which is Germany's main seaport, its proximity to Hamburg. And the British had Helgoland. It was the last remnant of their of the holdings of the British monarchs in Germany, the ruling dynasty of Britain, the Hanoverian dynasty. And they had been kings of Hanover in Germany. They managed to hold on to this one little island. Now they're giving this island back. And all these German nationalists, imperialists, criticize the government. Why are you giving away so much for so little? And their argument was because we want to cement this relationship with the British. But with Germany on such good terms with the British, the British didn't see any need to sacrifice their own freedom of action by making a formal alliance. And in any case, the British reversed the formal alliance as they feel it's kind of vaguely unconstitutional. Right? Can't lock the hands of succeeding governments through formal alliances. A good relationship is enough. Germans are not disappointed. Right? They had broken with Russia and told the Russians in no uncertain terms that they were not going to renew the reinsurance treaty. Okay? What was the consequence of all that for Russia? Well, the Russians did not like being isolated. It's never pleasant in a world of five great powers to not have any friends at all. And so the natural consequence was to tip the balance of power within the Russian government from those who favored the maintenance of a relationship with Germany to those who said we should move over more closely to the side of France. And in fact, in 1891, you have France and Russia reaching this agreement, the Franco-Russian Entente, it was called. An Entente is not a formal alliance. An Entente is an informal agreement to kind of coordinate policies, to consult with each other, and so on. You know, preceded by a naval demonstration the previous month. The visit of the French fleet to Kronstadt outside St. Petersburg, principal Russian naval base. The visit to Kronstadt takes place in July. The Franco-Russian Entente is basically agreed to in August, heralded by naval agreements. Important for reasons that I'll get to in a minute. Okay. What is the consequence of all of this? Notice that the Russians did this because the Germans had kind of forced them into it. What's the consequence? Well, the Germans shift their line. And now the Germans try to mend fences with Russia because this had been disappointed by the British. Now they didn't like the idea of Russia going over to France. Maybe they could wean them back. Okay? And they make these overtures to the Russians. And what is the effect of all this on Russia? It's like, we were afraid that moving over to the side of France would hurt our relationship with Germany. We were afraid that it might not be such a great idea from the standpoint of our own power and our own security to side with France. But now, look at the effect it's had. Right? It actually has improved our bargaining power vis-a-vis Germany. The Germans are much more interested now in being friends with us than they had been before, precisely because we have this relationship with France. Right? It's an argument for intensifying the relationship with France. And so they move to the Franco-Russian alliance of 1893-94. Okay. What does that story tell us about these Mearsheimer arguments? Right. The development of the alliance, Franco-Russian alliance, is not to be understood in terms of these two powers suddenly becoming much more afraid of Germany. As a matter of fact, when Germany was really strong under Bismarck, Russia especially was eager to remain on good terms with Germany. Now it seemed that the German position was weakening. Germany was more vulnerable, more isolated. Germany was the one who was now reaching out to Russia. Very different story. And as Germany had become weaker, Russia had become stronger, right? The purpose of this relationship between Russia and France, the purpose of first the Entente, then the alliance, was not to balance against a German threat. The purpose was to increase Russian power, to improve Russia's position in the international political system. And why did Russia want that? In large part because her goals were not purely defensive. She was not simply interested in maintaining security. She wanted power. Like this whole vision of the origins of the First World War, you want to understand it? Germans are becoming stronger. They tend to become aggressive. They lay on the First World War because they want to achieve hegemony in Europe. This is reaching for European hegemony, reaching for world power and so on. It's all Germany's fault. You'll see that whole line of argument is deeply problematic. You'll see that a lot of what happens has to do with the policies of these other powers, policies which were by no means purely defensive in nature. Both France and Russia are not status quo powers. They're interested in changing the status quo. Russia wants to expand down to the Turkish Straits through the Balkans. France wants Alsace-Lorraine back.
All right.
It turns out that the story is a whole lot more complicated, say the least, than Mearsheimer made out. And it would be complicated if we just looked at the policies of the Continental Powers. But there's a whole other factor that comes into play, and this has to do with Britain. Because this Franco-Russian alliance was not simply aimed at Germany. It was not simply aimed at improving the position of France and Russia vis-a-vis Germany. It was also aimed at improving their position vis-a-vis Britain. One clear indicator of that was the very important role that these naval visits played as heralds of this developing relationship. First, the visit of the French fleet to Kronstadt in 1891, and then the return visit of the Russian fleet to Toulon, which is the most important French naval base on the Mediterranean, outside Marseille, in 1893. Both France and Russia have all these problems with Britain. In the case of Russia, you have Russian imperial interests and British imperial interests clashing along the whole rim of Asia from the Turkish Straits straight through to Manchuria. All the approaches to India and Central Asia. So how even Afghanistan, middle of nowhere really, in 1885 there was this clash between the British and the Russians. And that's Russia. And then there's also France. France and Britain had been on relatively decent terms until 1882. As a matter of fact, Bismarck liked the idea that France and Britain had a decent relationship because given Britain's antagonism with Russia, this would tend to keep France away from joining forces with Russia. But in 1882, everything changed as a result of the British occupation of Egypt. As I say, it's something the British said would be temporary, but it ended up lasting until well after World War II. This drove the wedge between France and Britain. And in fact, France and Britain were at odds over, a whole slew of issues. So a lot of them having to do with colonial claims in Africa. The Egyptian issue remained a very live issue. The French didn't really give up. They tried, as we'll see, to kind of regain a certain leverage over the Egyptian thing by trying to dominate the headwaters of the Nile, the Upper Nile in the Sudan. This led to a very serious incident between Britain and France in 1898, the Fashoda incident. some of these conflicts between Britain and France went back to the 18th century. There's this big conflict over fishing rights off the coast of Newfoundland. It's like so there was tension between between Britain and the two new alliance partners. And part of the strategic rationale for the Franco-Russian relationship was that it will enable those two countries to join forces against Britain. And if the British fleet was caught between the French fleet and the Russian fleet, there was no guarantee that the British fleet would prevail. And unlike these continental powers, once the British lose naval supremacy, they're vulnerable to invasion. So there was this big anti-British edge. France and Russia are reaching for power, not simply seeking to restrain Germany as a would-be hegemon. It's natural in international politics. Okay. What does all this mean? It means that the situation as it existed by 1894, the great power political situations existed by 1894, is by no means clear-cut. Right? The whole Mearsheimer picture of Germany rising in power and the other powers balancing against Germany. Germany's this emerging hegemon and so on. It's such an oversimplification. You really wonder how much of the reality it captures. Even on its own terms, when you look at the figures for industrial production, fine, Germany achieving anything like near hegemonic status by this point. In as late as 1900, Britain is still Europe's most important industrial power by far. 18.5% of world manufacturing output is produced by the United Kingdom, as opposed to only 13.2% by Germany. 1900, Britain still outproduces Germany by 50%. That's quite an extraordinary margin. I'll just say another thing about whether Germany's growing industrial might translates into military power. It doesn't quite translate. And the reason for that is internal, having to do with the distinct character of the German political system, the socio-political base of the German state. It's like the social class that's the central pillar of that state are the large landowners of Eastern Germany. They're called the Junkers. These larger states east of the Elbe River, east Elbe states. Okay? These are the people who provided the German army, the Prussian army, and the other, with its officers. And the heart of the German army, the recruits, the enlisted men, were non-industrial workers. They were like peasants from these Junker-dominated regions. Much more likely to accept the authority of their Junker officers. The problem is, though, with the German, the shift in the economic and base of Germany, you have industrial workers coming to occupy a larger proportion of the German population. There's a shift in the distribution of wealth toward the middle classes in the center and in the west of Germany. And the natural thing in an ordinary political system would be to see those demographic changes reflected in the changes in the social composition of the German army and in particular the German officer corps. you expect to see a whole lot more middle-class officers. You'd expect to see a whole lot more people from the industrial working class as enlisted men in the army, right? But there was a deliberate policy preventing that. Why? Because once you, in effect, democratize the army, you're destroying the most important social basis for the existing political system, the system of Junker domination of this modern industrial state. And so there's resistance to an expansion of the army for those reasons. Because to expand the army, you would have to broaden its social base, both in terms of the officers and also in terms of the enlisted men. And this, they're unwilling to do. So the growing economic strength of Germany does not translate into growing military strength. It's like you may say, well, this is just a detail, but you got to bear these details in mind if you want to make sense of the story. Okay. Basic point here is this the whole international political system by 1894 is by no means clear cut, right? France and Germany have France and Russia, I should say, have this problem. Who's their main enemy? You really want to take on both Germany and Britain at the same time and drive them closer together against you? Well, that doesn't make that much sense. Well, you got to choose who to focus on. Who are they going to choose to focus on? And then there's also this whole problem of their relationship with each other. See, the alliances are not an unmitigated positive thing. Like, yeah, you get a partner who you hope is going to support you if you get into trouble, but on the other hand, the price you pay is the loss of your own freedom of action, because your partner is going to expect you to support him. And France and Russia do not have the same interests. You know, Russia does not want to go to war for the sake of France recovering Alsace-Lorraine, and France does not want to go to war for the sake of Russia's ambitions in the Balkans. That's the Franco-Russian alliance in the early days was a limited liability affair. It changed, but its change was not built into the nature of the of that relationship. It had to do a lot with the future course of relations among all the European powers. And we'll be talking about this a bit. And then, you know, for the other powers as well, things are very much up for grabs. Which way should Germany go? Should Germany try and wean Russia back away from France, dilute the new thrust of Russian policy by developing a certain relationship with Russia? Or should Germany just try and develop a solid relationship with Britain, basically bending toward the British to whatever extent she could, even if that meant, you know, growing tension between Germany and Russia. It was by no means clear which course of action Germany should take. Right? You know, and don't forget, Germany is weaker now as a result of these changes than she had been under Bismarck. Under Bismarck, Germany was the center. Bismarck was pulling all the strings. Now German freedom of action is severely limited because Germany has to face this very powerful bloc on both her eastern and western front. And then you have also the whole question of Britain. Which way will Britain go? Britain has this hostile relationship now with this unified Franco-Russian bloc. Does this mean that Britain should develop her relationship with Germany? As I say, once you move toward alliance, you sacrifice your own freedom of action. Maybe it would make more sense for Britain to trust to the divisions that separated these two great continental blocs from each other so that she could maintain her own freedom of action. Which way will Britain go? Right? That's the central question. And the answer to that question doesn't have to do with the Britons viewing Germany as this rising hegemon. All kinds of factors have to be taken into account. Anyway, so that's what we're going to be looking at next time. Which way Britain? Because that answer is going to have the answer to that question is going to determine a lot of what happens in international politics in the 20th century.